Are you a cheesehead?
Am I a cheesehead?
Yeah.
Well, yes. I'm a Packer fan. I'm in the suburb of Green Bay. When the Packers are winning, I can literally walk outside and hear the sounds from the stadium.
And so that's not a derogatory term. So if I call you a cheesehead, I'm not insulting you.
Not at all.
Okay.
When you're from Green Bay, born and raised, it's hard not to be a cheesehead.
Welcome to Trust Hacker, the podcast for elder and special needs law attorneys hacking their way out of the trust and tax jungle and seeking the sunny uplands of trust nirvana. And now, here's your guide, Bob Mason.
Today we have a very special guest, Dale Krause. Attorney Dale Krause is the president and CEO of Krause Financial Services and the Krause Agency. Both companies are Wisconsin-based corporations that design, develop, market, and distribute insurance products used in Medicaid and veterans benefits planning throughout the United States. Krause Financial Services works with attorneys to assist their clients to qualify for Medicaid or VA benefits, and the Krause Agency works with insurance agents to do the same for their clients. With over 25 years of experience, Dale Krause is a national veterans benefits and Medicaid planning advocate, earning the distinct reputation as the pioneer of Medicaid-compliant annuities. So today, we're going to hack my friend, Dale Krause.
The Trust Hacker is brought to you by TrustChimp, an educational resource for attorneys attempting to hack their way out of the confusing jungles of public benefits and tax law and to reach the sunny uplands of Trust Nirvana. Sign up for a free membership at TrustChimp.com. Gain access to educational membership materials, have the latest newsletters and articles delivered to your inbox, and stay in the loop on the latest offerings at TrustChimp. That's TrustChimp.com.
Dale, welcome to the Trust Hacker. Thanks for joining.
Thank you for having me, Bob.
I think this is going to be a good time, so let's just jump right into it. The thing that has perhaps jumped out the most to me about your background is you started your professional life as an attorney, and then you hopped over to doing what you are doing now. Can you tell us a bit about how you got into what you're doing now from practicing law?
Yes, I graduated law school in 1985, and I passed the bar in the same year. And my goal was to be a traditional estate planning attorney. So I joined a law firm up in Iron Mountain, Michigan, and the senior attorney in the firm at the time had drafted and put in place about 750 living trusts. And he was on his way out, headed to a retirement practice in Naples, Florida, so the practice was turned over to me. I thought that it would be an outstanding opportunity with 750 clients sitting there waiting for me, and I, you know, my first job or goal was to contact all the clients, make sure their trusts were funded, and then talk to them about changes that might have occurred since their trust was put together. And it didn't take me long to learn about the problems they were facing, primarily related to paying for long-term care. Many of the families would tell me about, you know, home health care agencies and what they were charging. At the time, there were very few assisted living facilities. It was a new place to go, but the ones that were there were also charging, you know, a pretty sizable sum each month for the care. And then the last ones really were the ones with the nursing home situations, where they had the highest cost of care, and it didn't take me long to realize that they were somewhat frustrated with the living trust because it didn't provide any protection for assets against long-term care costs. And so, you know, I looked into what would be a good solution. I first started out with traditional long-term care insurance, and I encouraged all of the clients who had existing trusts to seek out a long-term care insurance provider and see if they could get a policy. So that, coupled with the long-term, with the living trust, would provide what I thought to be the best opportunity. But a lot of the clients had a difficult time securing a product because they were either too old or they needed, you know, a certain level of care, and so they couldn't qualify from underwriting. And so most of those were faced with just spending down, and then they would eventually go on Medicaid. And so I had a chance to look at some of the Medicaid applications and trying to assist them with the Medicaid program at the time. And I learned very quickly that there were things they could do to accelerate their eligibility for Medicaid. And in the process, I looked at an immediate annuity and said, this would be a perfect vehicle if it was structured according to the requirements. And so I went out and I got a company to offer one to my clients. It worked in almost every case. And other attorneys from NALA, which is the National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys, heard about some of my opportunities and wanted to know if I could do the same thing for their clients. And so I thought, well, I never thought about being an insurance agent, but nonetheless, I got an insurance license, went out, secured the out-of-state or non-resident insurance licenses, and then I got an insurance company to actually put a product together for me, and I sold that product throughout the country. Didn't take but a couple years after that, and I was so involved in working nationally with elder law attorneys that I pretty much terminated my local law practice and transferred all of my files to other elder law attorneys in the area. And so today, here I am selling insurance products that are designed, developed specifically for Medicaid and veterans planning.
Okay, so did you have early on, were you handling short-term annuities?
No, in the beginning, the annuity approach was one strategy you could use to spend down. I mean, in the early days, I remember families could set up a joint account with their assets, and the joint account would be established with the child, and then the child could withdraw the funds, and, they were immediately eligible because those funds were not subject to any type of divestment penalty or gifting penalty. But the thing about the annuity was all it had to do is be an immediate annuity. Because an immediate annuity's design is such that if you give the insurance company a pile of cash and then they give back a contract, the contract says it will pay X number of dollars per month until the last monthly payment goes out. So in the early days, I had a company that issued a 30-year level pay annuity in all of my cases right up to clients who were age 99. And the goal back then was, especially in the individual cases where there's no community spouse, the goal was to have the payout so long that the client wouldn't get the funds during their lifetime, and the balance in the contract after they were gone would go to their children as the primary beneficiary. So, I used the 30-year level pay a contract in the beginning, and then as HCFA Transmittal 64 came out in November of 94, they came out with the actuarially sound test, meaning that you could not use a 30-year level pay annuity on an 85-year-old female. And if you looked at the life expectancy table they published at the time, it was stuck with 79 months. And so, again, the annuity product was an excellent tool, but now that you had to structure the return of the money over 79 months, I then got the insurance company to build what was called a balloon-style annuity. So on a $100,000 investment, it would pay about $100 a month in months 1 through 78, and then in the 79th month, which was the last month of the term, the $100,000 would come back less $780. And again, the goal was to backload the product in order to preserve the residual benefits for the next generation, who were typically the kids, as the primary beneficiary. So the
Of course, we don't do that now. Long
in the beginning.
Yeah, and of course, that's off the plate now. You mentioned something interesting that doesn't have to do with the annuity products, but it's something that we all encounter in the elder law area, and that's sort of the tension between the long-term care insurance industry and those of us who are involved in Medicaid planning. It's like one side is the good guys and the other side are the bad guys. And I oftentimes talk about how many of my clients' long-term care insurance really isn't an option. I mean, and I'm also mindful that LTC, long-term care insurance, the industry's had its own issues. I don't know how you feel about that or whether you let them do their thing and you do your thing or whatever.
Well, I think as far as long-term care insurance, you know, is concerned, I personally have policies because I know that, you know, if something should happen where I'm all alone and have to go to into a long-term care situation, the advantage I think long-term care insurance provides is, you know, you can get home health care benefits because most of us want to stay home rather than go to a nursing home. And so if I can go into get some home health care in my home and then transition, if necessary, to assisted living and then, you know, hopefully never having to go to a nursing home, you know, I've got long-term care insurance coverage to pay for that. With Medicaid in a lot of states, you know, Medicaid's only going to pay for a nursing home setting. And I think most of us, if we've spent any time in a nursing home situation, realize that it's not really the place anyone says, you know, when I get old, I want to go there. You know, we go there out of really no choice. The fact that we can't perform certain basic activities of daily living forces us into that care situation because of the fact, you know, they provide 24-hour care and can take care of us. When I have a husband and wife and they come to me for traditional estate planning and they ask the question, you know, if one of us doesn't get coverage for long-term care insurance, is it still worth it for the healthy spouse to take a policy? And my answer to that question is yes, because, you know, the first person going into a nursing home setting, you know, we can put that person on Medicaid pretty easily. I think it's the survivor. We'll assume that if the husband does go in and passes away after a few years in the facility, that if the wife is still healthy and at home, you know, she's going to be all alone. And a lot of times there's not someone in the house to take care of her like there was when he needed some long-term care benefits. So she likely took care of him during times when he needed long-term care benefits. But when she's all alone, you know, it's nice to know that you got a long-term care policy that can provide, you know, care at home, assisted living, or a nursing home. And then, you know, I don't think we can protect as many assets. In the case of a couple, it's easy to protect assets when the first person goes in because you have what's referred to a community spouse. So if the wife is the community spouse at home, you know, we can keep the house, the car, all the furniture and personal property, and $119,220 of cash or other assets. But I think when she's all alone, again, assume her husband went into a nursing home, was put on Medicaid, and then subsequently he passes away and she's all alone. I mean, the rules really dictate at that point that she, you know, she's got to get down to about $2,000. And so in many cases, she has to sell off the family home because it's no longer needed. And it creates a problem because we can't just give the money away. We have to put it into a plan. And most of the plans today on an individual case are going to consume about half the net worth. So if she had a long-term care insurance policy, the cost of the policy may be less than, say, 50% of her net worth at that time.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly something to look at.
Yeah. Okay. Let's take a hop back in time a bit. So when was it that you made the jump from practicing law into some sort of entity? I don't know if it was Krauss Financial back then, or when did you make the jump out of law? What year was that?
It would have been in the mid-90s. I started practicing in 85. I would say, you know, I worked with many clients through the end of the 80s. And then when I got into the 90s, you know, that's when I had gathered enough education, training, you know, talking to a number of families and having spent time working with the long-term care industry, that I realized that, you know, if I could develop a product and utilize it through elder law attorneys nationwide, that there was a market there that currently wasn't being serviced. So I would say in the mid-90s is when I decided that it was time to go. And so I had some products developed, took them out nationally to events like NALA, and I found that, you know, at first it was difficult for people to understand, you know, how it was going to work. But once they figured it out, you know, then it just took off and accelerated at a very quick pace. And then I couldn't find time to service local clients because I was on the road exhibiting, talking with elder law bars and all of that.
So it was a process. It's not like one day you woke up and said, this is it. I've got to hang up my law practice here and do this full time.
No, I actually enjoyed working with local clients, but then when I think one of my first colleague friends in Arizona called me up and said, could you handle an annuity? And when I learned about the size of it, you know, a size that I hadn't typically seen in northern Michigan, I realized back then there were commissions associated to the products because the products were long. You know, it was not only was it economically a perfect storm, but, you know, the commission on it was good. And so I could afford to go out and develop the practice because there was compensation related to it that would allow me to do that. Like today, I have 15 staff in my office that work with me every day to, you know, work in this industry because you do need, you need more than just a sole proprietorship to do all of the work that's necessary.
Mm-hmm. Well, you are, as I just said when I was introducing you, the pioneer of the Medicaid-compliant annuities. You're also, I think I could pretty safely say, the top of the heap. In fact, I'd be hard-pressed to try and name someone else who is out there doing it. So let me ask you this, Dale. What's the one thing that you do that you feel has contributed most to your success, other than knowing lots about annuities and Medicaid? What's the one thing that you think has gotten you to where you are, top of the heap, 15 staffers?
Right. I think with the fact that when we sell a product in a case, you know, there are states or counties where, you know, it may not work because they haven't seen it, but yet the elder law attorney who's on the local level who's working with the family says, you know, let's do it. You know, we'll go ahead and assist with the fair hearing. If we have to go up the ladder and go to circuit court or whether it's a federal action, you know, I've supported all of the business that I've sold, you know, by helping, whether it be drafting a brief, whether it means testifying. You know, I continue to support what we sell, and I think it's because of the fact that we just don't walk away at any point in time until everyone's happy. That's what really built the name and the reputation that I have today.
Okay. Interesting. Let me ask you this. When you do have to jump in and provide some support, you know, drafting a brief or otherwise getting involved with a product that you had originally put in place with that client, is that an add-on? Is that something that you do as an additional service, or is that just, no, I'm going to stand behind my product?
No, normally I'm going to stand behind the product. And, you know, in some of the federal cases, you know, I've even put up funds to assist with some of the costs because those cases can get quite expensive. And so, you know, I do whatever I have to because I think if I were to run away and hide when, you know, things are becoming adversarial, you know, it doesn't take long for people to become disenchanted, and I can honestly say that I don't recall losing any annuity cases per se. So, you know, again, I think it's the fact that we support everything we sell as much as we can, and the fact that we get the results that we're looking for that really has built this business. Doing anything short of that, I think I would have got a different result.
My name is Henry Lewandowski. I'm an elder law and estate planning attorney in Havertown, Pennsylvania, which is right near Philadelphia. I attended a TrustChimp Summit in Philadelphia recently, and I had a great experience. I've attended a lot of CLE covering trust over my 20 years in this practice area, and I think Bob's approach is great, and it's the best I've ever experienced. Bob combines knowledge of the subject matter with a lot of humor and passion, if it's possible to use a term like passion for such a confounding subject as trust law, but maybe that's where it helps unconfound things. Anyway, I thought the TrustChimp seminar was very rewarding, and I've convinced my partner to attend the next summit, and then we plan to both attend a second summit later this year because, of course, everything is better the second time around.
If you could go back and take a mulligan, I don't know if you're a golfer or not, if you could take a do-over on anything in your career since you've graduated from law school, what would it be?
Well, I think what I would do is, initially when I built the first product that came out to the market, I didn't know what I was looking at. And so I was an unsophisticated attorney working in a national marketplace, and it really did take off, and I didn't know how big it was. And so in the beginning, there were quite a few different companies that took notice of the product and then built their own product. I think I would have done more to, I'm not sure if you'd copyright it or do something to protect the design of the product for a specific purpose. But I gave everything away. I put a lot of people in the business. I did a lot to help others, not really knowing where it would end up for me financially, because that's just the type of person I am. I always did the same thing for my clients. I would go out of my way to make sure they're happy, and I to this day I still continue with that. But I think I would have done more in the beginning to protect the design and maybe captured more of it for myself, because today it's the product has changed a lot from what it was initially. With the DRA and all of that, the Deficit Reduction Act being passed in 2006, it changed a lot of things. So I've seen a lot of changes, but at 59 years of age, I'm still as excited to be in the business as I was when I took on my first case.
Did you have a lot of problem early on with seeing some of your ideas and your product out there in the market coming from elsewhere? Like you'd see an attorney with another type of annuity product and you'd say, hey, wait a minute, that's what I did.
Yeah, I did see that in the beginning. I would see other companies that would kind of coattail off what we were doing, and some of them were right, some of them were wrong. And I seen a lot of them blow up, but I was coming from a small town, practicing in a town of about 20,000. And so I wasn't familiar with all of the things you probably should have known or know, in order to really protect and preserve it. So, in the beginning there were probably 10, 15 companies that jumped in and immediately put agents out there trying to sell it. And, they all did well initially, but as rules tightened and things became more strict, most of those companies today are long gone. They just don't see the opportunity. I think most insurance companies want to sell a product to a 55-year-old and have them put it away for 20 years, and that's it. But, a Medicaid-compliant annuity or an immediate annuity that meets the requirements of the Deficit Reduction Act, they've got to have certain features, and there's no exceptions, and they've got to work immediately. And if, it's not something you just buy today and put away and hope to use, the attorneys that purchase it today are looking to put their clients on Medicaid this month or next month.
And you didn't mention it specifically, but one thing that I'll jump in with, and full and fair disclosure to you, the listener, is, of course, I'm an elder law attorney, and I have clients of mine have purchased Lord knows how many annuity products through your company, Dale. But one thing is the staff is very strong. My paralegal, Stacy, I can just tell her in broad general terms what it is we're looking for. She hops on the phone to Amber, and I'm not even involved until the final product comes back for me to look at. And the level of staff support is very good there. What do you see as being the biggest challenge out there over the next 5 to 10 years for the elder law bar?
Well, there's a lot of concern about, the Veterans Administration changing the rules for a VA pension, which is used to pay for long-term care. And there's constant rumblings that, Medicaid is costing too much, and we need to eliminate some of the things, including annuities. So I guess that's always been a concern. And if somebody would ask me when I initially got started in this business if it would have continued for 5 years or more, I probably would have said not likely, because anytime we develop strategies, and the other side being the entitlement programs understand them, typically they close them or make them less favorable. But I haven't seen that to be the case. And so I think if I'm a new elder law attorney and I'm worried about the future and the changes that might occur, so is it worth going in elder law? You know, we've got a lot of baby boomers that are retiring. We got Vietnam vets that are looking to need long-term care. And I think the demographics just say that, you know, we've got to take care of our seniors, and there's going to be a lot of them. And so I think, you know, I don't really see anything changing other than there's going to be more demand for what we do.
And you're from, being from Wisconsin, you know, the old term cheesehead. Did you ever read that book, Who Moved My Cheese?
No.
It's a fast little read. It's something that you read in an hour, hour and a half. Google it, Who Moved My Cheese? And it was kind of a trendy little book back, 5, 10 years ago. And the whole concept is who's going to adapt when they, quote, move your cheese. You were really touching on that without knowing about it, that, you know, the rules may be different. Some of the issues may be different, but the segment, the market is still going to be out there. You work with countless attorneys. What is the one thing that elder law attorneys, maybe in particular attorneys in general, do that drives you absolutely nuts?
Well, I think the only thing that drives some of my staff crazy is, you know, when you're trying to put a case together, because it has to be so specific, you know, we really have to know about all the assets and income. And sometimes, you know, families have a tendency to guess. And then when we get the plan finalized, then we got to revisit it to adjust everything because they found, you know, an additional $20,000 CD, or they found an old life insurance policy that has cash value. And I think that stalls out a lot of cases because most attorneys, you know, they'll wait till the end of the month to process everything, hoping, you know, with the intent to get eligibility as the first of the month. And because they wait so long in getting us what we need, and we you know, we're used to working it very quickly, so we still get it done. It's just when you have to make adjustments to the numbers because they find assets, you know, it causes a problem. Because again, every month that you miss out on, you know, it's going to cost the family somewhere between, you know, $5,000 and $15,000, depending on where they're located. And so I think that's a problem that I see as my staff. They'll say that I had to do 3 rewrites on one case, and it all occurred over 3 days because, you know, every day they got new information. So I think it's just compiling the information and then knowing that it's everything that's necessary, and then do one plan and then go from there, rather than trying to facilitate it in a piecemeal fashion.
And of course, your staff says nice things about my firm, right? Right.
Yes. As a matter of fact, you use all the intake sheets and supply us with all of the copies we need to make the determinations that are necessary.
Okay. A moment ago, you mentioned the VA. Putting aside for the moment the fact that that Damocles sword, those proposed regs are out there, where are we with the VA and annuities, like under the existing rules? I've heard a lot of confusion on that.
Well, in the VA program, we have to use an immediate annuity. It's not the same as what we use in the Medicaid arena. But and so the primary difference is this. With the VA program, if you put a block of cash into an insurance contract, which is the annuity, and it pays out a specified amount over a certain term, the VA doesn't have any actuarially sound life expectancy table, so there's no requirement that it be within a certain time frame. And then the other thing is, you know, the Medicaid wants it to be irrevocable and non-assignable, so it can't have any value in the secondary markets where the owner can sell it to Peachtree or J.G. Wentworth for a block of cash, because Medicaid says if you can do that, then it's still a resource to the extent of that value. But the VA doesn't go to that level, nor does the VA require that the state be the primary beneficiary to the extent of benefits paid. Now, with the Medicaid program, you know, if I'm all alone and I use an annuity, you know, I have to name the state as primary beneficiary because they want to recover their out-of-pocket costs. And so we have more flexibility with the annuity that we use for VA planning, so we can use a level pay or a balloon. Typically, we're going to make sure that we don't exceed the actuarially life expectancy because we may need the product to transition onto Medicaid. But that's it. I mean, we've got a lot more options in the VA side than we do on the Medicaid side.
Well, assuming these proposed regs come through in the form that we've all seen out there, what then?
Well, the problem with the proposals is that any time you try to reduce your net worth so that you get to the threshold level where you're eligible, the VA's proposed rules say that you can't, you know, put the money into an annuity. And so they want you, if you have cash sitting in a bank account and the cash puts you over the eligibility limit, they want you to keep it in the form of cash and continue to spend it down on your long-term care. And then when you reach the point of eligibility, then the VA will put you on the program. You know, what we do now with that same client is we accelerate their eligibility by taking the excess cash that makes them ineligible, and we put it into an immediate annuity. And then as long as the immediate annuity is structured so their monthly income is not more than their unreimbursed monthly medical expenses, you know, which is a simple calculation, you know, we're good to go. And so we'll stretch the annuity or use a balloon style, whatever it takes, to minimize the income so we get the full VA benefit. So, you know, again, looking at the proposed rules on annuities, you know, the VA is not going to let you use an annuity as a means of accelerating your eligibility for a VA benefit.
Have you heard any rumors? I'll tell you what I've heard. Any rumors about when those proposed regs might be coming in? I've heard maybe getting towards the end of the first quarter.
I've heard the same rumor. But, you know, again, I think if you look at the proposed rules, if they were implemented exactly how they were proposed, there's a lot of problems. I think, you know, for one, it's going to force a lot of people to seriously not even utilize the program because, you know, the Medicaid program is far more favorable when we talk about community spouses, whereas the VA program, I think a community spouse would feel impoverished if they had to get down to the limits that the VA benefit has proposed for the person who's at home being the healthy spouse. So if the veteran's in assisted living and the wife's at home and, you know, she wants to utilize the VA program to get the extra check each month to pay for his care, she might be better off utilizing the Medicaid program rather than the VA program.
My goodness.
Yeah.
You don't think they were trying to discourage people from using the VA benefit, do you?
Well, I think that's what happens. I mean, you know, when I look at the rule where you say no annuities, I mean, Congress is pushing seniors to buy longevity annuities where they can take part of their retirement funds and put them into an annuity that provides them an income later in life. And, you know, Congress on one hand is telling seniors to do that because they got to protect their retirement years, but yet in the same breath, they're saying, you know, you can't use any type of an annuity as a way to, you know, secure your financial future, even though most immediate annuities that we sell in a VA context, you know, they're not designed to protect for the next generation. They're just a nice way for the client to stretch their money out so they can stay on the VA benefit for the rest of their life and remain in, you know, an assisted living facility.
Well, how much do you really do in the VA area anyway? And that may be an unfair question. I mean, if you could put it, you know, Medicaid VA 80-20 or 90-10 or, you know.
Yeah, I would say 80-20. It seems like a lot of insurance agents that we work with really enjoy the VA program. But, you know, like in Wisconsin, for instance, Wisconsin has some waiver programs under the Medicaid program that allows seniors to get funds for care that typically would be viewed in other states as only available through the VA benefit. And so I have a very difficult time pushing VA benefits in Wisconsin because most elder law attorneys are of the opinion that the Medicaid program provides more opportunity for long-term care, you know, even at the home health care, assisted living levels versus other states where, you know, Medicaid doesn't pay anything for home health care assisted living. So, again, I think nationally 80-20 would be the proper mix. 80% of my time and firm's time is spent on Medicaid, 20% in the VA side.
Let's shift gears for a moment and go back to Medicaid and talk about H.R. 1771. And maybe you want to take a moment to explain to us what that is. I hopped on just a few hours ago and looked, and I see it's still languishing before the subcommittee. And it doesn't have any co-sponsors, which I guess is good. I heard a rumor that some people in Congress are trying to link its fate up with the Special Needs Trust Fairness Act. I don't know if there's anything to that. Anyhow, tell us about H.R. 1771. That's the bill that half of the community spouse's income from an annuity would be attributed to the institutionalized spouse.
Yes, I spent quite a bit of time on 1771, and it was all precipitated by the Morris decision. That was a community spouse case in Oklahoma where the community spouse invested some funds into an immediate annuity and then, you know, became eligible. And so when the case went through the court system, when it got up to the highest level and, you know, the community spouse was approved with the annuity, in other words, they said it was okay because the law allowed it, that it was a loophole.
How far did that go, Dale?
Well, the Morris case went all the way up to the appellate court. Let's see here.
I don't know what circuit that is.
Yeah, it went to the United States Court of Appeals, 10th Circuit.
Okay.
And so, you know, the court ruled in favor of the annuity and the community spouse who purchased it and just said, you know, there's nothing that the court can do because the law is the law, and they were required to enforce it. And so it took quite a few years from 2008 until 2012 to decide the case at that level. And so the Oklahoma congressman, you know, heard about the case, and it was in his jurisdiction, so he pushed the H.R. 1771 legislation and said, you know, we have to close that loophole whereby if a community spouse takes money that the couple has that's problematic for eligibility for Medicaid and buys an annuity, you know, the monthly payment comes to the community spouse, but H.R. 1771 says that it will come to the community spouse, but half of it will automatically be allocated to the institutionalized spouse. So what I did is I looked at the facts in that Morris decision, and I said, okay, if that law were in place and had been applied in the Morris case, the problem in that case was Mr. Morris, who was the community spouse, did not have enough income in his name to get up to his monthly maintenance needs allowance amount. In other words, he was allowed to have X number of dollars per month in income. And so under the calculation in his case, he not only needed all of his Social Security, but he needed his wife's Social Security and the annuity payment to get to that point. And so if the law were passed and it had been applied in the Morris case, it would have had no economic impact on the case because Mr. Morris was in the same position when it was all said and done. And so I think the legislation, because the Morris case was the catalyst for it, I think the congressman who initiated it should have looked at it and said, you know, if we were to apply it in the Morris case, which is the one that caught his attention, what would have been the economic result in favor of the government? And the result was no change, no economic change. And so, again, I don't see that legislation as making it through the system and being approved, because most of the cases are going to end up with the same result that would end up in the Morris case, whereby, you know, the law sounds like a good law. It sounds like it's going to have a great effect. But when it's all said and done, it doesn't do anything other than slow down the pace of processing a Medicaid case.
Have you heard anything about, and you may not have, of whether its future is linked to the Special Needs Trust Fairness Act, which is before the same subcommittee and seems to be just kind of sitting there?
I have not heard anything, and I wrote three letters on the on that legislation, with a letter going to each one of the committee members, just explaining that, you know, if Mr. Morris would have been in a state where the CESRA amount, the Community Spouse Resource Allowance, was the maximum, which is available in quite a few states, you know, he wouldn't have had to even buy this annuity. But Mr. Morris's case, and this is the point that really strikes me, is after his wife died, he waited two more years to learn the results of his case. And so at no time did the facility get a payment from Medicaid, because, you know, it was an adversarial case, and he never got approved for benefits until 2 years after his wife had died, you know, when the final decision came out and it was in his favor. So it's unfortunate that the facility had to take care of his wife for all those years, and then even after she passed, he had to wonder, you know, what's going to happen to this bill, all these nursing home bills, because he knew the size of the bill was astronomical for the years that she was in the facility. So again, I think it's unfortunate that they would have precipitated 1771 on the basis of the Morris case.
Okay. Well, Dale, let's wrap up here. We're running out of time. I'd like for you to take a minute or two to tell us what you would like for us to know about, how we can get in touch with you. Think of this as your 60-second or 120-second commercial spot, and if you do give us any kind of links or web addresses or email addresses or anything, I'll be sure to post those in the notes that can be found online for Trust Hacker so that folks can find you.
Sure. Bob, again, I want to thank you for having me today. And, you know, my practice can be found at MedicaidAnnuity.com. And so we've got a very comprehensive website with all of our contact information. And we take great pride in keeping it current. So most practitioners in their home states will find that we have everything related to Hawaii, Alaska, wherever they might be from, and they'll find the information as being very valuable. But we do offer a publication called the Krauss Report, which is a comprehensive guide on Medicaid and VA planning. And if someone would like a copy of that publication, we can send it out to them. All they have to do is go to my website and make the request, and I'll get a complimentary copy out to them, and that guide will help them to understand, you know, how we work with clients, primarily elder law attorneys and insurance agents, and what you can expect from us. So if you're interested in having us review a case, what do we do to facilitate the relationship and to provide the service that I said is so important to us? So again, I look forward to hearing from anyone who's been a part of this program today.
So that's a MedicaidAnnuity.com.
.com, yes.
Got it. Dale, I can't begin to tell you how grateful I am that you took some time out to talk to us, and I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Bob.
Dale Krauss. I am honored to call the man a friend of mine, and I admire so much the service that he has performed for the Elder Law Bar and those people that we serve. But Dale said a number of things that stuck with me, and I had to go back and listen a couple of times, but one thing in particular stood out, and I'll be curious to know if the same thing hit you. Let's see if you got it, and let's see if we agree.
You know, I've supported all of the business that I've sold, you know, by helping, whether it be drafting a brief, whether it means testifying. You know, I continue to support what we sell, and I think it's because of the fact that we just don't walk away at any point in time until everyone's happy. That's what really built the name and the reputation that I have today.
And that's the hack. Dale, of course, was talking about a product and service he offers to the Elder Law Bar. But what he said can apply to a product and service that we, as elder law attorneys, offer our clients. Of course, as attorneys, we can't guarantee results to our clients, but we can certainly be there after the fact to support, listen, answer questions, maybe even explain to the odd banker or social worker what we have done. And, hang on to this, at no charge. It may set you back a few hours here and there, but in the long run, it'll pay you dividends in the form of a solid reputation in your market. Thanks again to Dale for a great conversation. Be sure to head over to trustchimp.com and sign up for a free membership, and you'll get all of our latest news. And on that, I'm out of here.
Trustchimp.com.